Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is April 26, 2015, and this is episode 78. I want the one I can't have, a look at supply constraints in gaming from a historical perspective, or the inevitable Amiibo episode. Welcome, once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're taking a wholly uneducated look at supply restraints and how that relates to our favorite hobby. So buckle in and get ready for that. But first, we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits. In addition to that, we also have a real quick news story that we'd like to talk about because we didn't see any mention of it in any of the big gaming websites.
Shame on you.
Shame on you. Slag, you want to kick us off?
Yes. Read Only Memories from Midboss Studios, who you probably know best from the GamerX GX convention, will be releasing on Ouya PC, Mac, and Linux on August 18th. So it finally has a release date.
Ouya?
Yeah, Ouya is the console exclusive, remember?
Oh yeah!
So yes, if you are looking forward to this tribute to 90s adventure games like we are, then please look forward to it.
Excellent, excellent. You know, I'm actually really looking forward to this game. I'm a big fan of Snatcher and, you know, all of the games that this is really sort of a tribute to. We've talked about it here on the show tons of times over the last few years. The thing that really gets me is that this information was not posted on any of, like, the big gaming blogs, not even the ones that have in the past been supportive of Midboss Studios.
Well, you know, joystick something something.
I suppose that's really, you know, unfortunately true. Let's see, we also have word here. Right after we talked about it on last week's episode, Project Cross Zone 2 was confirmed for a Western release. It'll be releasing in North America in this fall, actually.
So
that's something, yeah, definitely to look forward to. In addition, Dissidia Final Fantasy for Arcade is now in its location test. You know, you can go online and you can find a lot of information on how the game plays now. You can go over to YouTube and you can see people who, you know, snuck their cell phones in and took camera footage of, like, the game actually being played.
Ooh, naughty secrets.
There wasn't a whole lot that we didn't already know in terms of the game playing similar to the PSP game, except with, you know, 3-on-3 player teams rather than 1-on-1. But we did find out that there will be persistent characters in the arcade version, and you'll be getting what are called Nessica cards in order to save your characters to. For this event at the location test, they're going to be given away for free. They'll probably be, like, 100 yen purchasable cards when the game launches in arcades later this year.
Lovely.
We also got word from Ichiro Hazama-san over at Square Enix that Final Fantasy Dissidia for Arcade will be getting downloadable characters as the game goes on, which is super common these days. You know, we're actually seeing arcade games get new characters down the line after release. That's sort of always been the thing, and now it's like really a prominent part of arcade game design. And the reason why we found this out is that specifically they were talking about how Noctis from Final Fantasy XV is going to be one of these characters that gets patched in.
Yeah.
So that's something that's very exciting. And last, but certainly not least, we had word from Tatsuya Nomura talking about something that we had talked about ourselves a little bit last week, that basically they have quite a few potential characters to use, and following Ramza, who is from Final Fantasy Tactics and will be a playable character in Dissidia Final Fantasy, there are plenty of characters from derivative works, and we're taking a look at characters from the main numbered series that have yet to make an appearance too. So it's very clear that we're going to be looking at a big roster for Dissidia Final Fantasy in arcades. And I just can't wait to hear more about this game and hopefully get to play it at some point.
Yay!
Nomura-san, at the same time, also talked about the Kingdom Hearts series, which is that we're going to be getting more information on Kingdom Hearts 3, including at the Kingdom Hearts event at the upcoming D23 Expo. As well as that, there's going to be announcements related to smartphone development for the series, that they will announce in the near future.
I wonder if it's going to be a mobile social card-based game. Except for Kingdom Hearts, that would work, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we've basically already had that with...
Yeah. In Pokemon news, Pokemon Company has officially revealed Hoopa Unbound, which we had talked about way back in the discovery of the code ever since, that we've talked about ever since Hoopa was discovered in the code for X and Y. And, you know, the Unbound form is its true form and will be, you know, just like another form of the Pokemon. We don't know how it will be distributed yet, but please look forward to it.
Indeed, and we do know
that... Oh, and I'm sorry, that's obviously going to be for Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire.
Indeed, and we do know that the next Pokemon movie, which will be airing on Cartoon Network later this year, is all about Hoopa. It's called Hoopa and the Clash of Ages. So for those of you who have gotten past a certain point in Alpha Sapphire and Omega Ruby, you can probably already start making guesses at what this movie is going to be about and what Hoopa is all about. We also got word, much like Fire Emblem Awakening before it, that Fire Emblem IF is going to be getting downloadable content. So far we have the announcement of DLC characters for Marth and Lucina, and if you're in Japan and you intend on playing the trading card game Fire Emblem Cypher, each of the starter decks will actually come with downloadable codes for the character that the deck is based around. Specifically, the Marth deck and the Lucina deck will come with codes for Marth and Lucina.
Nice. In World of Warcraft's next patch, you'll be able to build ships. This is part of the garrison feature. You'll be able to build the shipyard, and you'll be able to finally access Cannon Jungle, which up until this point has not been accessible aside from the intro quests. There will be rare creatures and hidden treasures throughout the zones. There will be naval missions, and... Oh, right, it's Hellfire Citadel. That's why I was excited a couple weeks ago when I read this, because that's going to be the new raid, which is, you know, for those of us who played back in the Burning Crusade, Hellfire Citadel is where, like, all of the five-man dungeons were.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we also got word here that a new character has been announced for Pokken Tournament Fighters. This was during the Nico Nico Chokagi event for 2015. Nintendo and Bandai Namco announced that the newest playable fighter is going to be Gengar.
Gengar!
This is, of course, very exciting, but unfortunately, the trailer that announced him did not have gameplay footage of him.
Well,
apparently,
boo.
His inclusion is based around a Japanese Twitter poll that took place following the announcement of Pokken Tournament.
Yeah, the Gengar family of ghosts is very popular.
I mean, oh, yeah.
How could you not love Ghastly Haunter and Gengar?
Seriously, I love Gengar. He's super cute.
I love all three of them.
One thing we do know is that in the trailer, he does have a power-up mode where he turns into Mega Gengar.
Well, of course.
So please look forward to that. In similar news, and this is somewhat weird because this announcement was made during Capcom's part at the Nico Nico event, but Tekken 7 in the arcade has a new character coming in the next patch. On April 28th, the new character will be Gigas. He appears to be a giant ogre of some kind, probably related to the character Ogre. And last, but certainly not least, we got word of another PlayStation-exclusive character. Actually, two, but one that I'm particularly interested in, for the PlayStation 4 version of Super Time Force Ultra. This is the robed figure from Journey.
And it looks so cute.
Of course it does.
Well, I mean, it already looked cute, but it's even cuter.
Something that's super interesting about the character is that it's very specifically designed to be a non-violent character. His abilities are all about, like, moving without, like, killing your enemy and, like, stunning them in order to get by them. So I actually think that's really interesting and cool, especially for a game like this that is, you know, super shooty shooty bang bang. The second new character is Sir Galahad from the Order 1886. And he is a more traditional character. He comes with his trademark Luger pistol and arc rifle. So this, of course, joins the from the announcement last year of the game coming to PlayStation 4 at all, playable Shuhei Yoshida-san.
Yes!
So... we don't yet have a word on when this is releasing, but when it does, I'm sure you'll be hearing a lot about it from us.
And obviously, this is not for the Xbox releases.
Of course. We also have a couple of release date updates here. The first, and this is actually really cool, Mega Man... Capcom and Nintendo are teaming up for another Mega May event, where every week they'll be releasing a new Mega Man on the Wii U Virtual Console, much like they did last year. This year's games are going to be Mega Man and Bass, Mega Man Battle Network 3, Blue and White, Mega Man Zero 2, and Mega Man Battle Network 4, Red Sun, Blue Moon. Capcom Unity is having a poll to determine what game will be released first. So if you want to get yourself over to Capcom Unity, we'll have a link to that poll over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And last but most certainly not least, J-Stars Victory vs. Plus will be releasing in North America on June 30th, along with official confirmation that the character roster has been preserved from the Japanese release.
Yay!
And all characters in the game will feature their original Japanese voiceovers.
That means that we get to play as Koro-sensei. Yay!
Indeed. All right, Slaggy, unless you have anything else, it's time for some news.
News. Oh my god, news.
So, oh my god, it's news. First off, we have a story here that Guitar Hero is officially coming back. You know, we've been hearing word about Guitar Hero coming back for a long time now. And finally, the official announcement has been made that Freestyle Games, whom you're probably familiar with for developing the extremely underappreciated DJ Hero series.
Oh, yes.
Is behind the Guitar Hero, reimagination? This game is going to be called Guitar Hero Live, and it is, it is a plastic guitar game, but the guitar is completely unlike any plastic guitar we've had so far. It doesn't have colored buttons at all. It just has two rows of three buttons sort of near the top of the, what would you call that, Slaggy?
Fretboard, and actually it's three rows of two buttons.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at it in terms of two columns of three buttons.
Yeah.
Either way, this isn't Excel. We don't need to differentiate between columns and rows. I actually am really excited about this. The game, it does have a familiar-looking, note highway. Comes down the middle of the screen. It has your notes on it. Something that's weird, of course, is that there's only going to be three lanes for notes. And you're just going to have to differentiate between white notes and black notes, with white being one column of buttons and black being another column of buttons. And even weirder is that this game is going to be played in the first person using real, FMV. Obviously, we're no longer in the days of Night Trap and Sewer Shark. So, the FMV, it looks pretty good. It's footage that was recorded at an actual concert, and you're basically going to be, playing as a guitar man in a band, and there are several video streams, so if you do worse, you'll start getting footage of, the crowd hell of booing you and being not into your music at all.
The only thing I wish that they would do is where it's, in You Rappin' Bad, or You Jammin' Bad, where the music just gets
the whole backing track starts to get down-tempo. Yeah, that would be amazing. But either way, this sounds like a really interesting reinvention of the game. I'm kind of interested in this weird presentation, even though I don't quite get why they're doing it that way. Certainly, they say that there will be two ways to play. There will be this mode, and then there will be almost a music video mode, where you'll be able to just play music videos of songs, and they will play in the background rather than this concert footage. It sounds like a really wild reinvention compared to what we're used to from this genre of music game. And something else that's interesting is that there are only guitars. There's no vocals, there's no drums, there's not even bass guitar. If you're playing two-player, you will both be playing the exact same note chart in, a score competition. There is no, competitive band element to this game at all. So it's, to me, a little bit risky, because I really think that the music and, guitar genre of music games have really grown to be considered as, party games and, cooperative events. But, that having been said, we've talked here on the show quite a bit about how if they're going to bring Guitar Hero back, they have to change it up.
Yeah.
About how, Rock Band is really all people are going to need. Rock Band 4 sounds like they're sort of just perfecting the old style of music game. So, to me, the only way Guitar Hero and Rock Band can continue to live side by side is if one of them takes a big change. And it sounds to me like Guitar Hero is going to do exactly that.
I was just going to say, the only way for this to not be a repeat of what happened a couple years ago is if they preserve their individual identities and
they need
don't
to
oversaturate
go
the market.
Their own way.
Go their own way.
I didn't mean to sing over you. I thought you'd appreciate that joke.
Of course.
Oh, I'm sorry, but continue finishing?
No, I was just saying that, you know, they also need to not oversaturate the market, which they both seem to be pledging to do.
Yeah, they do. Both Harmonix and Activision are saying that they're looking at Rock Band 4 and Guitar Hero Live, respectively, as like once a generation updates that they will be supporting with online features rather than new disc releases every 8 months. And I think that that could be really good. I personally plan on buying both now.
The only bummer is no import DLC such.
Well, yeah, because the game, it won't even exist the way the old
right,
games
right. I know.
Existed.
I'm just saying.
I feel you, and I am really happy my DLC for Rock Band is carrying over. And the Guitar Hero Rock Band, some of it was actually some really good stuff. But that having been said, I'm forgiving the lack of DLC carryover for Guitar Hero. Specifically because they're going in such a new direction, I appreciate that they would have to redo everything in order to bring that over, and it's probably just not worth it to them, like financially.
Yeah.
We also got word here that the Yi's Chronicles 1 remake is going to be heading to smartphones and tablets in Japan. Specifically, we are talking about Ancient Yi's Vanished Omen, which is going to be releasing on iOS and Android, quote-unquote, soon.
Yep, this, of course, is the PSP and PC version of the game. So, a new Saint Seiya game, courtesy of Dimps, is coming to PS3, PS4, and PC. And this is called Saint Seiya Soldier Soul. It's going to run 60 frames per second to 1080p. And, yeah, it looks good, you know. It's basically what you would expect from a Saint Seiya game.
Excellent.
At least so it appears to be.
That's great. And, apparently, all of the characters and downloadable costumes from Saint Seiya Brave Warriors will continue to be available in Saint Seiya Soldier's Soul.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. We also have word here of a new line of Sega 3D Classics for the 3DS. And these ones have already been confirmed for a North American release. We're going to be looking at 3D Streets of Rage 2 in July, 3D Gunstar Heroes in August, and 3D Sonic the Hedgehog 2 in September. Just as with all previous releases, all three games will have both their original release, like classic versions, that will be like straight one-to-one ports, and we're also going to see a bevy of new modes and features, just as we always see in these 3D releases.
Now, just to clarify, this is the Mega Drive version of Sonic 2.
Yes, it is.
Could you imagine if they're like, Sonic 2 in 3D, Sega Classics 3D.
And it's the Game Gear
version. It's the
version.
Game Gear, yeah.
Obviously, if you've never played Gunstar Heroes, this is the time to change that. Streets of Rage 2, obviously, is a classic. And Sonic 2 is a really, really great, well-designed game. I'm definitely in for all three of these. And I have to feel like anybody who's listening to this show would probably enjoy all three of these games.
Yep.
We also have word here that Mitsunori Takashi-san, whom you're probably familiar with as directing the Dissidia Final Fantasy games for PSP, is going to be working on a new game called Rampage Land Rankers. This game is going to be launching in Japan this May for iPhone and Android. It's being developed by Hexadrive and will have character designs by Tetsuya Nomura.
Nice.
We also got word that Taiko no Tetsujin is getting a PlayStation Vita version. Appropriately enough, this is called Taiko no Tetsujin V version.
Aww.
And is going to feature crossover video game songs from such games as God Eater 2 and Freedom Wars, as well as a focus on, like, J-pop and anime songs.
And Vocaloids.
And Vocaloids. There's also going to have another RPG quest mode, very similar to the most recent iteration of the series on 3DS. This is going to be releasing in Japan on July 9th, 2015. It's unlikely that it would be releasing in North America, but remember, Vita games, if you're talking about cartridges, are region-free, so feel free
yes.
to import this one. I sure will be. You may have heard that Square Enix was teasing a game on its website some number of weeks ago. Well, on April 15th, that announcement was officially made. This game is Star Ocean 5, Integrity and Faithlessness.
Oh.
So, Integrity and Faithlessness is apparently specifically meant to be a game focusing on elements from earlier iterations in the series. They're very specifically making this for fans specifically of Star Ocean 2 and 3. So for those of you out there who are a little disappointed with Star Ocean 4, I think this is definitely something you should keep your eyes open on.
Yeah, so hopefully it's in good hands at Tri-Ace.
At Tri-Ace, yeah. You know, they obviously made the earlier iterations of the series. And this game, from a story standpoint, is going to take place between the second and third games in the series. We also have word here that Overlord, the underappreciated but still well-loved by its fans series where you play sort of an anti-hero in almost like a Pikmin clone, like you're controlling the devil who has his little minions and you're trying to take over the land or whatever. It was a lot of fun. It was also very weird. It's coming back, this time with a spin-off called Fellowship of Evil. This is going to be a multiplayer third-person action game similar to like a Diablo loot fest where you and up to three friends can grind for loot and play through the world of Overlord. Rihanna Pratchett, who is the series writer for the game, very specifically said on Twitter, "This is not Overlord 3. People who are worried about this game being a departure from game design from the other Overlord games should not worry, because this game's existence does not rule out Overlord 3.
Yeah.
So, that's a bunch of good stuff. Slaggy, you want to take this next one?
Yeah. Patrice Desilets has announced his first game since leaving Ubisoft, and that will be called Ancestors: The Humankind Odyssey. So we don't really know much about it. There was a reveal teaser, but it was literally just like a teaser. So, I mean, one could assume that it would take elements of the Assassin's Creed games, but, you know, hopefully not with, like, random bugs.
Yeah. We also have word here that we are getting a 3D Adventure Time game.
Yes. Oh, it looks so good.
Yeah. We don't know a whole lot about the game other than it has a sickening, super cool looking, like almost like claymation and art style. It just looks really pretty, and it's apparently going to be coming to basically every platform this fall. So please look forward to that. We also have word that the Fairy Fencer series is getting another sequel. This time we have Fairy Fencer F Advent Dark Force. And once again, we are going to be seeing collaborative efforts here between Yoshitaka Amano, Nobuo Uematsu, and Toshiki Inoue. This series is, you know, fairly well-liked, and, you know, we've just finally started getting these games coming over to North America, so while we haven't yet heard anything about this specific game, I anticipate we will.
That's great news. And a big surprise, you will soon once again be able to go to GameStop and get some retro games. That's right.
Something that's really cool is that most GameStops will be taking in games for platforms such as the NES, the Super NES, the Nintendo 64, Sega Genesis, PS1, Dreamcast, and, you know, you'll be able to bring your old games in, including accessories, though they're only looking for first-party accessories. And you'll also obviously be able to go to stores once your store is participating in this program. Right now, there are only two stores running it as a pilot program, but GameStop has very specifically said that on a fast timetable, they want to expand this program nationwide, so fingers crossed that they get there. You'll be able to just walk into GameStop and start buying old games. They've also talked about how you know, they're going to try not to, like, overprice these games. They're going to try not to overprice, like, complete sets. And, in fact, even charge the same for a complete set for a cartridge-only game. So, in a lot of ways, this could end up being a cost-effective way to get into retro gaming, which is not something I ever imagined I would be saying.
Right. Heroes of the Storm, which is Blizzard's MOBA, will be officially launching on June 2nd. Right now, they're doing the Heroes of the Dorm competition that's kind of, you know, building hype for it. And so it looks like the beta is doing really well since they're officially going to move into release.
On the off chance that you are not in the closed beta of this game, which, you know, it's like the biggest closed beta of all time at this point, but on the off chance you're not in it yet, it will probably please you to know that the beta is going open starting on May 19th. We also got word that the next iteration of the Star Wars Battlefront series, which we here in studio are huge, 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 huge fans of, will be hitting on PC, Xbox One, and PS4 on November 17th. This game is going to take place during the original trilogy, and it sounds like it's going to be have gameplay very, very similar to the old games in the series, which, to me, is a good thing.
Yeah, apparently, with Disney on board, I mean, how could they not be doing it right, you know?
Right. You know, we also have word that there is going to be a level that takes place in the storyline of The Force Awakens. So that's definitely something to be looking forward to, since, you know, I'm in huge Star Wars mode right now, and I have been, and I feel like I'm going to be probably for the rest of the year.
Rest of the decade, let's be real.
All right. We also have word here from Square Enix that Final Fantasy IV, The After Years, is getting a full 3D remake on Steam. Now, this full 3D remake originated on the iOS and Android platforms, as most of these Steam versions have. But this one is interesting because it's apparently going to have a new intro by Visual Works, which is Square Enix's CGI department, and that supposedly wasn't in the phone versions of the game. So it's going to be releasing in North America on May 12th at a retail price point of $15.99.
If they could remake Final Fantasy IV The After Years in full 3D, why can't they make Final Fantasy VII in full 3D?
We also have word from Square Enix that on June 16th at 9 a.m., they are going to be hosting their very own E3 conference. Obviously, this is a big deal since these big conferences typically only go to companies typically only do this if they have, like, big, exciting news for the event, you know, big titles, big announcements. I am super hype here.
Yeah, that's going to be exciting.
My one worry is that that's the typical time slot that Nintendo does their E3 Direct these last couple years. So, like, if the Square Enix event and the Nintendo event are at the same time, I'm going to have a real conflict of interests. Obviously, I'll watch the Nintendo one live and watch the Square Enix one after, but I hope it doesn't come to that. Nintendo, do yours at 8 or something. Jeez. We also have word that the PSP games... No, you heard that correct. The PSP games, Summon Knight 5 and Class of Heroes 3, are being brought to North America by Gaijin Works and Monkey Paw. They will even have physical retail releases in case you want those UMDs, but fortunately, even the physical releases will come with download codes for you to redeem on your Vita.
Nice.
And last, but certainly not least, we have word that Shantae and the Pirate's Curse came out on PC earlier this week.
Yay!
You know, obviously this was the game that came out on 3DS originally, then it got a Wii U port, and now it has a Steam port. The retail cost is $19.99, and it includes controller support, achievements, trading cards, badges, and unlockable profile backgrounds. So, that's about it for our news, but wait, what's this? We have something that is...
controversial.
Oh my god.
Sure, Jan. Alright, well, first up here in controversial news was the ninth hour realization that Mortal Kombat X has some, what some have called exploitative downloadable content. I'm talking here, of course, about the $5 pack of 30 quote-unquote easy fatalities. And what this basically does, if you have easy fatalities, is let you do a character's fatality by inputting a simplified button input. Typically, based on the ones that I had checked out, it's typically like down, down, low punch or something. Like, you know, real simplified. Many people have defended this choice, of course. You know, free market stuff. Hey, if you don't want it, just don't buy it. Which I typically fall into myself, but there's something in this case about this that just turns my stomach a little bit. And I think that's mainly because I know a lot of people who have never been able to do, like, fatalities and like, super combos in fighting games and stuff. And basically, like, you know, I'm all for games being more accessible. I know I talk about how I like challenging games, and in fighting games, something that I like is the high barrier for skill. Like, I like those kinds of things, I'll admit. But as I get older and I get more respectful of other people's, like, circumstance, the importance of accessibility becomes more and more apparent to me. And this, to me, is an accessibility issue. And it just, to me, to charge for accessibility seems really gross.
Now, this, I assume, would only affect, like, single-player mode, or...
Well, no, I mean, they are just fatalities, but you can do these in online play as well.
Oh.
But, you know, again, the argument that a lot of people are making is by the time you're using a fatality, the other person is lost anyway. So, like, it's not affecting the actual outcome of the fight. I still think it's gross. I think that this is an accessibility issue, and I think it's kind of gross to sell to people. But, I mean, again, ultimately, I appear to be in the minority. You can unlock some easy fatality tokens just by, like, playing the game and, like, going through, like, the series standby crypt mode where you, like, purchase unlockables. You can unlock packs of tokens for these that way. But to me, if you're gonna have this as an option in your game, I think it should just be an option, not something that's gated. It's, like, a really cool idea that they took to, like, a kind of gross place, I feel like.
Yeah.
In good news on Mortal Kombat, though, there was some controversy when the game released. As people played through the story mode, they realized that there was a single line of dialogue that states pretty clearly that the character Kung Jin, this is of course like the nephew or something of series standby Kung Lao, is in fact a closeted gay man. Actually, I thought it was really tasteful. It was kind of heartrending. In a flashback, Raiden is trying to convince Kung Jin to join the, like, Shaolin monks, like, to become one of them. And Kung Jin, I guess, is like, I can't, they would never accept me. And Raiden is basically just like, you know, they only care about what is in your heart, not whom your heart desires.
And then some dumb commenter on New Now Next, which is where we are linking to, said, this is dumb, he said that because he's a thief, not because he's gay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, not whom your heart desires is pretty clear. The game's directors, including the cinematic director, but also just the game director, they've all been very positive and very much confirming, like, yes, Kung Jin is a gay man. We're not focusing on him being flamboyant or whatever. Like, he's just, it's there, it's in his story, and it's there in the exact same way we would have done a straight character. And I have to say, fuck yeah, I applaud you, this is awesome.
Yes.
Something else that was controversial was that Bungie announced that the upcoming Destiny expansion, House of Wolves, will not have a new raid tier. Instead, rather than developing a new raid tier, they're developing a whole bunch of new game systems. And they're developing a whole bunch of new single-player content, and they're basically trying to change the entire game's, like, play loop. Whether this is gonna work or not, I guess we won't really know until House of Wolves releases on May 19th, but this was a very controversial thing that happened when they announced that there was no new raid tier. People were pissed. If you want to read more about the specific changes they are going to be made, we'll link you over on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
And last but not least, we have two news articles that are closely related. Earlier this week, the biggest game magazine in Japan, Famitsu, of course, held their annual awards ceremony. Typically, every year, Hideo Kojima attends the Famitsu Awards, which is the name of said ceremony. This year, for the first year ever, he did not attend. This obviously ties in pretty deeply to all of the rumors and news that are flying around about Hideo Kojima and Kojima Productions, Metal Gear, and Konami's general fuckery. But this ties into the next controversial thing, which was just this morning. Unfortunately, word hit that Guillermo del Toro confirmed to IGN that his collaboration with Hideo Kojima on Silent Hills is not gonna happen. And right on the tail of that, Konami came out with the announcement that PT is going to be permanently removed from the PlayStation Network store on April 29th.
Ooh.
Between these two things, it sounds like Silent Hills is officially no more. And it certainly sounds, between these two things, like Hideo Kojima's time at Konami is definitely at an end. So, smoke 'em if you got 'em. I think things are about to start getting dark for us Metal Gear fans. I think we're looking at a Castlevania situation all over again.
Yep.
All right, Slaggy, unless you have anything else to talk about, I think it's about time to get into this discussion.
Let's do it.
So, we're going to talk a little bit about supply constraints, You know, something that often comes up in these discussions is, you know, Nintendo has a little bit of a history with regard to the idea of, like, controlled supply constraints. But I really felt like the first step here to having this discussion was really to go over the basics of the economic principle of supply and demand. You know, there obviously are four basic laws of supply and demand. Obviously, you know, if demand increases and supply remains unchanged, a shortage will occur, which leads to a higher, you know, value of a product or item. If demand decreases and supply remains unchanged, a surplus occurs, leading to a lower price or value. If demand remains unchanged and supply increases, a surplus will occur still, leading to a lower price or value. And if demand remains unchanged and supply decreases, which is, you know, like an intentional shortage, the shortage will occur and the price will or value will go up. These are I'm explaining this principle primarily because this really ties into sort of collector culture at large and specifically within games culture. You know, obviously, if you look back, there were limited print runs of many NES titles early on, and every video game console that's ever existed has had some games that had small supply runs. Obviously, there have been console shortages. You know, PlayStation 2 was famous for that. The Nintendo Wii was huge.
Yep.
So we even had some of those with the PlayStation 4 release, although Sony worked really hard to get more units into the retail channel much faster than we've seen with some of these other consoles. I think by, like, March of last year, they already had things under control. There's only those first, like, 6 months where really there was more demand than there was supply.
Yeah, but it's still very common even to this day, as you're saying.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to talk a little bit about some memories that we have about these things and talk a little bit historically in games of examples of supply constraints. And obviously we're going to lead up to talking about really the focus of the conversation here, but I really want to build this on something else so that I can make my point when we get there. So, Slaggy, I know you had some NES-era titles that you wanted to talk about that had some supply issues. Do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, this is a game that we've talked about before, which is the 10th-gen version of Tetris, which might be the version of Tetris that you remember fondly for NES. Of course, the history of this game is that it was that Atari did not have the rights to be producing Tetris, so there was a limited print run, and they canceled and recalled a bunch of copies from stores and actually destroyed them. So, you know, this ended up really limiting the availability of this version of Tetris. And, you know, a lot of people preferred this version of Tetris. I'm not one of them. I like the official Tetris better, but you know, I was too young at the time to really be aware of, like, the market implications of this, but I'm sure it must have caused quite a deal of confusion.
You know, and this is something that's funny. Everything I know in life, I tend to trace back to, like, how video games taught me that. Video games taught me about supply and demand as a principle when I noticed that by far the most expensive game for Funko Land to, like, buy back from you was the 10th-gen version of Tetris. Most of my games I would go through, and most of my games, the repay value, like what they would pay you to buy them off you, was like $10 to $15, and then 10th-gen Tetris they would pay you $99 for. And
wow.
And so that for me was sort of my lesson on, like, wait, there are not a lot of these, and that is why it is worth money. And, you know, so in a lot of ways that really sort of formed my worldview on collecting right there was, you know, this game, they didn't make very many copies due to extenuating circumstances. Some of the video game mags talked about it at the time. Certainly not Nintendo Power, you know, but, like, I feel like I read about it in video games and computer entertainment or something. And it was just really interesting, you know, the sort of effect that this had on the price of the game. And, you know, we would see that sort of pop up again, even in instances like Mario 3, I think, had a shortage when it first came out.
Yeah, you know, I honestly don't remember at the time.
Zelda 2 had some issues, as I recall, where they shipped to, like, Canada, but not North America initially.
Ooh.
So, I mean, you know, this, unfortunately, we're sort of seeing a history with Nintendo, and we're going to get to this, and how Nintendo basically made a game out of this, like, literally made a video game out of supply and demand as a concept. But I want to talk real quick about an article I found over on Mental Floss. We'll link you over at GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
That basically takes a look at some of the most expensive video games to be sold in recent times. And something that's interesting is that they're pretty much all Nintendo NES games. Stuff like Stadium Events, which was, of course, the first, like, Family Fun Fitness Mat game. That one goes for, you know, like, $10,000 if you have the box, but it's open and played and has some wear and tear. Like, $10,000! You see prices like this for games. You know, they also talk about Air Raid for the Atari 2600, Kizuna Encounter for Neo Geo, where there's, like, 15 copies of that. You really start to see the pattern here that the fewer copies there are of something, the more money it's worth on the market. And I understand why people who are listening now are probably like, that is a super obvious economic concept. Like, why are we even still talking about it? And the reason really is foundational. A lot of people get really mad at supply constraints, especially when they feel like they're artificial, like they are controlled constraints. But they're ignoring the fact that supply and demand is like a tightrope walk. Like, when we were talking about the basic principles, the other side of supply and demand is when you make too much of something and nobody wants it and you can't unload it and you end up filling a landfill in Arizona with copies of E.T. because nobody wants it.
See, I was going to talk about, like, bargain bins at Toys R Us and Walmart.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was taking it really to the extreme example.
Pet Sources Adventures.
But, you know, this is, funny enough, a good example of a game that falls on the other side of that, and we're gonna go forward a generation to the Super Nintendo generation, was actually Earthbound.
Oh, yeah.
We talk about how loved Earthbound is now. But what we're missing, and those of you who had, like, a Woolworths near you may remember this too, I saw a copy of Earthbound at Woolworths back in the day, contemporaneously, in the bargain bin for $9.99. And that was, like, the big box that came with the strategy guide. It was, like, huge. And that was, again, like, $9.99, because stores had paid hella money for this stock of this game that Nintendo promised retailers was going to be a big hit, and everyone ended up having to liquidate their inventory, basically, because nobody wanted to buy this game. And, you know, when you really stop and think about it, people lost a lot of money on that. And so, you know, I get why in these situations where people want more copies of a game, more copies of a toy that will unlock things in their game, or what have you, I understand the personal desire to have these things, but you also, I feel, need to take a step back and look at what the consequences are to misread the market and overproduce. And certainly I'm not really talking about Amiibo here per se, because Amiibo clearly, there is more demand than there is supply, by far. Nintendo could certainly use with producing more Amiibo. But, the thing that, of this conversation that people I think forget, I've heard people talk about how, demand for Villager is so high that Nintendo should be making more Mario Amiibo than Villager. Like, no. Half of the demand for Villager exists only because Villager is hard to find.
Yeah.
Villager on his own merits is not an amiibo that would sell soup as well as a Mario or a Yoshi or a Peach. So from a business perspective, at least the first days of the amiibo line, in Wave 1, it makes sense for those supply constraints to exist where they do. Anyway, we're really getting ahead of ourselves. I want to pull back, reel back here. Because I know that Slaggy had some Super Nintendo Game Boy era games that he had wanted to talk about, including a game that literally makes a game out of supply and demand.
Yeah, so I'm actually talking about Pokemon, because the whole point back in the day was who had the most epic legendaries to, you know, beat your team. And what that really ties into in a lot of ways is the way that the event Pokemon used to be distributed. And, I mean, this is something that continued up until
the DS era.
Up until the DS era, right, because I specifically remember going to a Toys R Us with Captain Spike, and there was a Mew giveaway. It was for probably, like, Fire Red, Leaf Green, I'm guessing. And we got there at a pretty reasonable time. The line was already out the door, and basically, there were still probably about 50 people in front of us in line, and they're like, oh, we're out of Muse, sorry. And there was a 13-year-old boy in front of us who almost cried, like, and I don't mean just like, you know, like a little like almost threw a tantrum in the middle of the Toys R Us.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, it's funny because the early iterations of Pokemon have some of these concepts baked into the game. As Slaggy said, you know, some of the most powerful Pokemon were fairly uncommon. You had to go to events to get them. And so, I mean, to me, that's a really interesting principle taken right from this. And something that Nintendo, I would argue, has built on that is that in the higher competitive scene, you start getting into how Pokemons are randomly assigned various natures, and they have, like, these IV stats that, like, you can't even really track in-game very well. And to me, it's sort of, you have to raise a Pokemon, like, super, super well, and take advantage, and just have, like, the right amount of, like, luck and, like, perseverance and, like, finding the right stat combination and, like, the
and,
right
like,
nature.
Literally, like, if you're raising it against, like, wild Pokemon, killing the right Pokemon to raise your, like, values.
Well, yeah, exactly. So Nintendo's really made a game out of rarity and, you know, demand to some degree, especially when you get into, like, the meta level of, like, people raising specific Pokemon to trade with other people. I really feel like Nintendo sort of gamified this concept. You know, that's certainly my personal opinion. I'm sure there are people who disagree. They think I've got the read of Pokemon all wrong. And, you know, that's certainly fine. I feel like there is a definite element of playing the odds in Pokemon of sort of risk-reward, especially as sort of is focused very specifically on, like, the random and thus, you know, uncommon nature of some of these Pokemon combinations. So, you know, but we'd be remiss not to talk in a conversation about rarity and supply and demand, not to talk about some of, like, the more rare games. And when I say rare games, I don't mean, like, Donkey Kong Country. I mean stuff like during the Saturn era, we had, like, all of those Working Designs games and Shining Force 3, you know, Panzer Dragoon Saga. Obviously, more recently, we had stuff like Xenoblade Chronicles and Metroid Prime Trilogy. Even Kirby Return to Dream Land in North America. Just games where, even though these could have and should have been successful games, they were really undershipped and underproduced by their publishers, and as a result, even now in the resale market, these are games that sell for, you know, $80 to $200, depending on circumstance.
Yeah.
Something that's really interesting about the idea of supply and demand as relates to game rarity with retail games, though, is that, especially in the 360, PS3, PS4, Wii U, Xbox One era, is that now pretty much every game that comes out on cartridge or disc or whatever, you can also download.
That's true.
So you'll end up with a game where, like, okay, well, that disc is hella rare, but you can still play the game super easily. Which, to me, is kind of an interesting best-of-both-worlds perspective as a gamer and a collector. I have tons of games that are super rare, but in recent years, you know, I've had instances where games that I know they're going to be rare, I missed out on pre-ordering, I was unable to get them, but I'm still able to play them because I just bought it off, you know, PlayStation Store or whatever. I think that's neat. I think that's really interesting. And I think that is, especially within the games space, a unique opportunity to serve your user base while still retaining the concept of supply and demand for the collector market on your product. This is, of course, a concept I'm very specifically staking out because I'm going to be coming back to it in just a couple of minutes. I just want to ask Slaggy, PlayStation 2, do you remember how rare that was when they first came out, how hard it was to find a PS2?
Oh, yeah, and I didn't even jump on board right away because of how cray-cray it was. I waited at least 6 months.
Oh, me too. How about the Wii, the original Wii?
Oh, well, I mean, I remember being in line at Walmart launch night and not even knowing if I would be able to get a copy. A console, thank you, yeah. Because they said there were only, like, 20 or something, and I thought I might be, like, there were, like, maybe two people behind me, and that's where the cutoff ended up being.
What about these special edition 3DSs? Have you ever tried to get one of those? Have you ever gotten one of those?
Yeah, I have the Link Between Worlds 3DS XL.
Excellent.
And that surprisingly actually was still kind of available for a while. I didn't get that right away, but, you know, even something as recent as the Majora's Mask one, I mean, that's impossible to find, not marked up, you know, to at least twice its value.
Which, obviously, is the exact point of what we're talking about here.
It would be a problem if they released the regular size one on the faceplates, and everyone could have a pretty 3DS, new 3DS. Honestly, that was part of the reason why I just decided, you know, I actually really like the way that the black new 3DS looks, and I just was going to go for it, because rather than trying to be like, ooh, I want that special, and then just, like, keep waiting, you know, I just thought, you know, I'm just going to go for it.
What about the 360? That had some supply issues. Did you, by the time you got one, was there any supply issues?
No, there weren't.
PlayStation 3, I know that you got a PlayStation 3 early initially. Did you get it within that window where they were still hard to get?
Yeah, and I mean, I remember being very lucky to have one, and then it was just kind of like, oh, there's no games.
Isn't that one of the few, like, home consoles you ended up selling?
Yeah, I traded it in for my 360, and then I ended up, of course, getting a Super Slim, which we talked about. That happened during the course of Game Buoy, you might remember.
Excellent, excellent. And last but not least...
But, you know, actually, funny enough, the Super Slim, although, I mean, that's because that was a holiday, kind of like a holiday bundle, holiday deal, but, you know... Like, even with some of these things, like, you know, then there's, like, the Black Friday bundles and stuff, but when I got my PS3 Super Slim, that was right after Christmas, Christmas Eve, so, you know, it was a special price and a special bundle. It wasn't, like, a fancy case or anything, you know, it wasn't, like, painted with Uncharted or whatever, but, you know. So I was even, you know, looking around and had to drive, like, 30 miles, and I called the Target. I'm like, please hold it for me. Because that was the, like, bundle that came with the PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale, which I guess I don't know why it was really worth that, but still. You know, even with things like that where there are, like, special bundles, you know, we still see this very limited stock.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I want to talk a little bit, before we get to talking about Amiibo, I want to establish something, because, again, a lot of people have come for Nintendo, and I guess ultimately this episode is another sort of in defense of Nintendo episode. I want to talk a little bit about how supply and demand applies to other sort of retail fields, that is to say, non-gaming. Obviously, you know, Apple has made an entire...
Oh, yeah.
They've made an entire multi-billion-dollar business out of these concepts. Create something super fancy, charge a premium for it, and make it hard to get initially, and the masses will eat it up.
I'm going to wait 3 days in advance for the iPhone 6 Plus, or I'm going to pre-order it. I'm going to wait all night to pre-order it, and then it won't come for 5 weeks until after it's actually released.
I was gonna say, didn't you and I wait for Nintendo Wiis that way? But no, I pre-ordered my Wii like a month in advance in my local GameStop. Like, they had a line overnight out the door.
Yeah, and I was not available for that, and that's why I had to Walmart it night of.
Oh, wow, yeah. You know, obviously, so Apple has made like a whole business out of this.
The iPhone, the iPads, and the everything's and this and that.
But something else that was actually notable in national headlines was that last Sunday, Target began a limited time clothing collection for women's clothes. This was the Lily Pulitzer for Target collection. Lily Pulitzer dresses and what have you will cost you several hundred dollars. My understanding is that some of the super nice ones you're looking at closer to $1,000, but I can't really verify that myself. I mostly read about this in the news and on social media. But apparently the 250-piece collection that Target had items priced between $2 and $150. So for most people, this was like an affordable way to get couture clothing, high-end clothing that they view and really wanted. And apparently these lines were out the door at basically every Target the morning of for like hours. Like, we're talking about lines several hundred people deep. And apparently most stores were reporting complete sellouts within 2 minutes. And, you know, this is really an instance where Target identified a market, they identified a product that would have high demand, they produced a small enough number to still make profit, but while also knowing that not everyone would be able to get these, which would keep their demand up and thus keep their perceived value up. And, you know, Target has very specifically said they will not be doing another run of the of these materials and these items, and basically the people who got them are lucky and the people who didn't are just, you know, not going to have them.
You know, the funny thing is that I was just at Target yesterday looking at some of the Anna and Viv collection, which is their plus size line, and I swear there were like a few things hanging on the Lilly Pulitzer rack there. It must have been like just the things that people didn't really want or something.
Maybe like a Lilly Pulitzer, like a bracelet or something.
I have no idea, but I swear there was a little bit on the Lilly display.
Well, shit, we should go over there, pick some stuff up, and sell them on eBay.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm like, I can't fit into that. I'm not a skinny girl.
No, we'll sell them on eBay. Come on now. You don't need to be wearing them in your drag outfit in order to make a profit. Obviously,
could you imagine,
know,
I'm like, I'm wearing Lilly Pulitzer from Target.
You know, obviously the 80s had such things as Teddy Ruxpin, My Pet Monster, the 90s gave us such things as Beanie Babies and Tickle Me Elmos.
Oh, Lord, and Furbies.
Furbies, yeah.
Oh, man, and I was, you know, I was around for the original, well, I mean, you were too, but, you know, I was very aware of the toy market during the Furby craze. And I'm wanting to say, even when the Furby resurgence came back, when they did, you know, when Furby got relaunched, that was still kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, I think things were still pretty nuts initially. I ended up buying two in that time period. I loved Furbies for a minute. I couldn't even tell you why at this point.
For the camp factor. And the fact that
the
modern Furbies are, like, able to have personalities in both of ours automatically channeled Valley Girl. They're like, ole, tute, mune,
ue,
hey.
So, anyway, this is all leading up to sort of where we're at now. You know, Wave 4 of Amiibo released this week. You might not be able to tell because you probably couldn't get a hold of any because they are harder to find. I almost was going to go to a really misogynistic place for an analogy, but no, let's just say they're super hard to find. And unfortunately, you know, we're looking at things like apparently Best Buy of Canada sold out of them online. They had their entire Wave 4 of Amiibo sold out in less than one minute.
That's crazy.
Less than
it's like
one
a Taylor
minute.
Swift concert tour,
right? You know, Amazon in North America hasn't taken their pre-orders for them yet, but every other Amazon store in the world has. Even people who successfully pre-ordered at Amazon UK are now getting messages from Amazon that even though they were told the item was available, unfortunately, they will not have enough quantities to ship to all of their customers. So, Nintendo has created a really advantageous situation for themselves in terms of profit. To me, this is a good thing. I worry a lot in the game. Hold on, because I'm going to come back to that, but let me finish my thought. Nintendo is a company that I worry about a lot. I worry about all video game companies these last few years. I've talked about it a lot here on the show. We've seen a lot of really great publishers and developers get closed down due to bad management and poor business choices. To me, frankly, the Amiibo allocations, at least for the first two waves, made complete sense. You ship a ton of Mario, a ton of Link, a ton of you know, Kirby and Pikachu, and then not so many Foxes, but still a fair number. And then, you know, not so many Samuses, but still a fair number. And then, you know, significantly lesser of, like, the Fire Emblem characters and the Animal Crossing characters, because let's be real, they don't have the brand awareness associated with the other characters. Certainly, now, I think we might be past that point. I think Amiibo anything at this point tends to sell pretty well. You look at the store-exclusive Amiibos, Lucario, Ness, Shulk, Jigglypuff. These are all Amiibo that sold out, like, within seconds of being ordered for pre-order on, like, Target and GameStop
and, you know, I'm just
Toys R Us.
I haven't looked at the Mario Party 10 sales numbers, but I'm willing to bet that they were pretty good considering the gold amiibo at Walmart.
Yeah, that gold amiibo was another one where basically with every allocation that Walmart would put up on their website, they would sell out within minutes. And that's just for a gold Mario variant that supposedly they produced pretty big numbers of. So I bring up all of this supply and demand really to talk about what I see as the future of amiibo. You know, we have heard from Nintendo that they're going to be producing cards of the amiibo that will have the functionality of the full amiibo figures, but be much easier to find. You'll be able to just buy them either individually or in packs, and they will be widely produced and widely available. And to me, this is sort of, you know, I was talking earlier about how there was sort of the compromise between collector culture and actual, like, gaming culture with, you know, the current generation of consoles, how you can just buy digital copies of games you can't find physical copies of. To me, that is that kind of compromise slash solution in the retail space for these collectible items that have in-game unlocks, is to have these cards for the amiibo that are a lot easier to get. So, you know, they may not have the prestige attached. Certainly displaying a binder full of amiibo cards isn't going to give me the thrill that my amazing amiibo collection gives off showing
off. Don't rub it in.
But at the same time, I know Slagkick had some nightmares over wanting a Captain Falcon amiibo he wasn't able to get. Would you at least be happy if you could get a Captain Falcon card and still at least get the in-game stuff?
You know, the funny thing is, and I think this is a really good perspective to share about collector culture and the amiibo craze, is that at a certain point, you know, there's a barrier to entry almost for people who are, you gotta catch them all mentality. Like, at this point, I have a Link amiibo because, you know, I'm a big Legend of Zelda fan, even though Captain Spike always rolls his eyes about that.
I'm not rolling my eyes about you being a fan. You do you, girl.
And, you know, I probably will pick some more up eventually, but I will never try to be a diehard amiibo collector just because at this point it is not impossible, but financially unrealistic for me to even try to pursue that. And I know I'm not the only person that way, that a lot of people have just kind of been like, F it in terms of amiibo, because they either want it all or they want all or nothing, you know?
It's funny you say that, because I myself nearly gave up on collecting amiibo during Wave 1. I was never going to get into amiibo in the first place. And then I got sucked in, and then I was nearly forced out when that first wave became really hard to find. I couldn't get a Wii Fit trainer, and I was getting, like, really upset about it. And
there were some obscenities thrown in the SS Game Boy studio.
Oh, for sure. Luckily, my AmiBro came through. He was able to import one for me, so I did get one.
Are we going to talk about the situation in Japan?
Well, why don't you... Here, 1 second. The story here, in so much as there is a story, is basically that, as things stand right now, there is a way higher demand for amiibo toys than there is supply of amiibo toys. The two trains of thought going on right now in chief are that Nintendo should either increase supply and hope that demand stays up, or create an alternate supply, like these cards, that are in much higher availability to keep demand up for the toys while also alleviating the people who just want them for gameplay purposes. So why don't you talk a little bit about the amiibo situation in Japan, Slaggy?
Oh, I just, you know, when people post pictures of bargain bins that have, like, Shulk and Captain Falcon and Ike in them, and they're just like, F you, Nintendo of America, F you! And, I mean, I think it just really... you would be the one to speak about this more, about collector culture in Japan, and even you've talked about it a bit with, like, the variant 3DSs and all that sort of thing, and that when you go into a store in Japan, that they, you know, it's a wide variety of things displayed. There's, like, 10 colors of everything, and so, I mean, you'd probably be able to speak better to that, but... Yeah, like, the thing is that if you really want that Rosalina and Luma, you can probably import it for not too crazily, you know.
Yeah, most of the import ones that my AmiBro and I went in on came out to, like, $20 each, which, after shipping and stuff, like, to me, that's a reasonable price, since certainly, you know, if I just went for, like, a scalper for an American one, I'd be looking at paying $60 to $70.
But what is your awareness of the AmiBo situation in Japan?
My understanding, how
that ties into Japanese collector culture.
Well, my understanding in Japan is that amiibo are popular, but not as crazy wild popular as they are in North America and otherwise, because their allocations, my understanding is, their allocations were a lot more even, and basically all of the characters got made in roughly similar quantities. So you're not just going to Toys R Us and finding, you know, 40 Mario and nothing else. You're going to, you know, your local Bic Electronics or whatever, and you're finding three or four of every amiibo. And so as a result, you know, the fervor isn't as intense there because that demand and supplier are equivalent. You know, people there who want amiibo can go get amiibo, and outside of a couple of the figures that are being imported by people all over the rest of the world, Shulks and Marths, the others are all super easy to find, which to me is almost an interesting lesson. I know that we all are mad about amiibo, we're all mad that we can't get the amiibo that we want when we want them for the price we want to pay for them, but I have to ask, you know, as someone who tries to think about the business side of things, if I were Nintendo, would I do anything differently? I mean, I appreciate the concept that hearing that a store is out of stock in seconds, it's like, okay, well, then we're missing some sales on people that would be buying right now. But the flip side is, if you say, oh, we just sold everything we produced in seconds, ignoring the opportunity cost of lost sales, like, that's a successful product, and as long as you did your budget right, you should be making hand over fist on that transaction. Like, that should be a very profitable situation for Nintendo to be in. So even within myself, like, as much as I as a consumer would like to have these items and these cute little toys, I have to sort of think about it from the perspective of the business, like, no, I don't know that I would be handling this that much differently. But again, you know, I do see sort of the salvation of the player base, the people who are upset that they can't raise their Captain Falcon to fight them the way they want to be fought. To me, the salvation is in alternative amiibo products. These cards sound very promising to me, while still allowing people like me, the collectors, the people who want to have shelves and shelves of amiibo beautifully backlit by LEDs in little glass cases or plastic cases. Like, to me, I see the benefit in nurturing that situation, frankly, while also providing the mass market with an easier way to get the in-game functionalities. And I don't think that one necessarily devalues the other by virtue of being, you know, a different product. In fact, I almost feel like a lot of us collectors would probably end up double dipping, especially if any of the amiibo cards had, like, variant artwork. Like, could you imagine, Slagkick, if there were three different artwork cards of Shulk and, like, one was more rare than the others?
Booty short.
Yeah, like, if there was a booty shorts.
Oh, well,
Shulk
then this
could
create the situation all over again. People are going to, like, be like, oh, I'll trade you my butt shot of Captain Falcon for the booty short Shulk. You're like, is it a one star or a two star booty short Shulk? Is it a holofoil?
The crazy thing here is, I mean, you say this, but as long as you could get the common versions of each card, which in-game were identical, for a customer like you, Slaggy, would that be less valuable, or would you be happy to finally have that?
I'd be happy for it. And I can't help but think the fact that they're making card amiibos, like Pokemon trading card game, like, it really seems like almost inevitable that that's gonna converge in that direction.
Oh, I absolutely foresee a Pokemon card amiibo line where, you know, it's like Pokemon Rumble World, I would assume. You have that kind of game. In fact, Pokemon Rumble U used NFC figures to bring your character, your Pokemon
into
the game.
Proto amiibo.
Well, exactly. So to
proto amiibo.
To me, Nintendo has basically laid the groundwork for what you're talking about, I feel. And the next step would be these amiibo cards. And again, as long as the cards all have the same value, or in-game, I think that the cards, for the most part, would all be really sought after, a product that Nintendo would benefit from selling and that most of us would be interested in buying.
Now, I know that you are a player of Disney Infinity. I believe you've not really done the Skylanders thing, though.
Yeah, I have not done Skylanders.
But for Disney Infinity, we don't really quite see this craziness, do we?
Well, no. And in fact, a lot of people who look at these toy-to-life games, which is the sort of genre that people have labeled these games, a lot of them talk about the fact that Skylanders has a collectible element, it has a rarity element, there is supply and demand at play in Skylanders, and most Skylanders people are fanatics about it. They love it. They spend hella money on this stuff. The Amiibo, or the Disney Infinity fandom, by comparison to Amiibo and Skylanders, there is no real collectability element. There are occasional limited edition figures at Toys R Us, but in-game, they're the exact same figures. It's just like, oh, this is the crystal clear variant of Fantasia Mickey. These don't get the same level of fervor, and a lot of times you end up seeing, like, last season's Disney Infinity figures even go on clearance. And, like, I got a Merida from Brave at Target for, like, $4.99 or something, which I can't imagine ever getting an Amiibo for that money.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, you kind of bring up the
unless
point.
Unless they ever made a Daisy Amiibo.
Well, that one, yeah, right? No one would want that. Unless it had a weird third eye under its hair.
Oh, no.
But to me, that's a really interesting point, because the Disney Infinity, you know, a lot of people thought it was going to be, like, a huge, hot, super wanted item. And while Disney Infinity has been profitable for Disney, it has definitely not made a splash the way Amiibo have, the way that Skylanders have. And, you know, for me, it's hard not to wonder, is that the direct result of avoiding a supply-demand situation and making everything equally available? Is that why people are less compelled by the Disney Infinity figures? Or is there a relation to the fact that a lot of people think that Disney Infinity as a game is less interesting than Skylanders or Smash and Mario Party, which are the big Amiibo titles right now?
Good point.
Anyway, I mean, I guess I really want to wrap this up. I don't mean to defend Nintendo completely. I don't mean to say that Nintendo is wholly, you know, in the right for handling this line of products this way. As someone who collects and wants all the Amiibos, the Amiibo supply... the plural of Amiibo is still Amiibo. This supply situation is something that really upsets me pretty often, in truth. So, I certainly don't mean to come off here like I'm wholly in favor of Nintendo adopting this sort of mindset with regard to how it treats the market.
But you can recognize that it's, you know, economically a sound decision.
Exactly. Exactly. And especially if they do get this Amiibo card line off up and onto shelves, so that I, you know, maybe I'll never get my Little Mac Amiibo. If I could get a Little Mac card so I can still raise a Little Mac Amiibo, like character in-game, I'd be pretty happy. So, Slaggy, do you have any final thoughts on this topic?
No. Class dismissed.
Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it.
So, last week, the Mewtwo update finally went live for Smash Brothers for 3DS and Smash Brothers for Wii U. Obviously, you know, the DLC character became available for download, and even for people who didn't buy the DLC character or didn't get the free DLC from Club Nintendo, which was the case for everyone so far, since the actual sale version doesn't go up until this week, everybody got the update that was released for the game alongside Mewtwo. And this update, which had Mewtwo as well as Mii costume DLC that everyone could purchase, also had some interesting stuff hidden within the data of the update. Many people now in the 3DS hacking and custom firmware scene have taken this update data apart. And there's been some really interesting things found out. And, you know, I appreciate that even as we say this, a lot of people are going to be like, okay, that is too outrageous. That is obviously false. The thing is, this data is here. This is 100% fact. The data we're talking about right now is definitely 100% for fact in the update data for Super Smash Bros. For 3DS. Super Smash Bros. For Wii U update data was very specifically, like, scrubbed of metadata. Everything was hidden and put together super carefully. There was no extraneous data. But the 3DS version had all kinds of sound data for multiple DLC characters that haven't been released yet, including a really big surprise. So first off, it did have sound data for Lucas, which, you know, we already know Lucas is coming, so that's really exciting. But even more interestingly is that it had sound data for Roy from Fire Emblem. You might remember Roy as a playable character in previous iterations of Smash, where he was a clone character of Marth. But what is more interesting, and this is the crazy part, because, you know, we do have the capacity to play these sound files. You can, you know, hear the sound files that are theoretically going to be in Smash in the future via this data. The last one is labeled SF2 Ryu.
What?
And when you play it, it is, in fact, Ryu's theme from Street Fighter 2. The file is clearly identified in the sound file name as a player character victory sound. So, by every and all indication, Ryu appears to be a character that may very well be coming to Super Smash Bros. 4.
Wow.
Obviously, you know, all kinds of things can happen. Licensing deals fall through. People start mock-ups of characters and then don't finish them because ultimately they're not, you know, going to be a part of the game. They were just being mocked up. So this doesn't really mean we are definitely getting Roy and Ryu download characters, but things start to look really fishy. The official Smash Brothers website has slots for 5 more DLC characters after Mewtwo, and a lot of people now are thinking that we're probably looking at, in addition to Lucas, whom is officially announced already, we're probably looking at Roy and Ryu as the next two downloadable characters. Obviously, it's impossible to say for sure this is going to happen. It could have just been a plan that went, you know, fizzed out.
Yeah.
At least right this very moment, if you have Super Smash Bros. On your 3DS and you've done the update, you have Ryu sound data in your update, like, for sure. And that is, if nothing else, the grounds for some very, very possible rumors. With that having been said, I'd like to talk a little bit here about an article I was quite fond of on Kotaku. This is, of course, our weekly Smash, and this was actually meant to be a Smash that we were going to bring up last week before we got sidetracked. So I'm just going to say screw it and include this week, even though normally I'd find a new, more contemporaneous Smash. This article is called How a Small Studio's Chance at the Big Time Died at Microsoft's Doorstep. And it's basically a little article that sort of is about the history of the studio Darkside Games, whom you are likely familiar with for being the brains behind the reboot of Phantom Dust. And this article basically talks about the development of Phantom Dust and some of Darkside's previous games, and basically how, due to Microsoft kicking them off of this project unexpectedly a month or two ago, which we talked about back in February, I guess, that basically the studio had to close down despite how happy they and Microsoft were with the work-in-progress Phantom Dust project.
Yeah, just a sad story.
It's a sad story, but it's super well-researched, it's super well-presented. I thought it was definitely worth a read, and if you're interested in these kinds of stories, I definitely think you should check it out. You know, and this is exactly the kind of thing I was talking about a little bit earlier. Studios are closing left and right these days. It's hard not to worry about basically every studio right now, as far as I'm concerned. Like, if you're not Square Enix, basically I'm worried about you. And even then, some of Square Enix's studios don't get treated super well. Slaggy, do you have anything to add about this, Smash?
Nope, just I agree. It was really well written, and just it's unfortunate to see these sorts of things happen, but, you know, that it was presented really well.
All right, well then, hey, what's going on?
I said, hey, what's going on?
Slaggy, if you'd like to kick us off and talk a little bit about what you've been playing this week.
Yeah, I've been putting more time into Snooki Wanna Smush Smush. Smash Brothers, in particular, putting some time into the 3DS version, which I really had not spent a lot of time with, so it's been kind of fun, and, you know, definitely plays a lot better on, in my opinion, on the new 3DS than it did on the old 3DS, so that, you know, that C-Stick is nice to have, even though it's not quite the same as playing on a GameCube controller. I think that will still be my preferred way to play. And in light of all of the excitement from Star Wars weekend and the Episode 7 trailer and stuff,
celebrate!
I decided to, just on a whim, jump into Star Wars The Old Republic, a.k.a. Jedi Simulator. And, you know, I just intended to just pop in and see, oh, just kind of revisit it because it's free to play now. And I got so hooked back into it that I decided to pay for a month. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And I just, you know, it was unfortunate that it went free to play because, really, it is probably still one of the strongest MMOs out there. And BioWare really did a superb job on it. And, you know, just from the way that they did the flashpoints, which were like the dungeons, and, you know, you have all of your dialogue trees. So, I mean, it's just, it's really a full-fledged BioWare experience. The combat, you know, plays like a, you know, any traditional MMO, but still really well-polished. The classes still feel really, like, fun to play. And I'm playing a Jedi Consular Shadow Tank, and so that's been really fun. I have a double-edged lightsaber, and it's just, like, it's just the attention of detail that they put into that game is superb. And I hope that, you know, they continue to support it, even though it's, you know, you still have to buy the expansions and stuff. So it's, I would say, more like a Guild Wars in a way, except that Guild Wars does not have any, you know, Guild Wars doesn't have any sort of a subscription model at all, right?
Yeah, it's just straight up, you buy it and you have it. Although there are microtransactions in the form of, you know, like, similar to what we have with cartel coins.
Right, and my understanding is that things like Rift also still have subscription options available, and probably even like Lord of the Rings Online, things like that. But, yeah, it's for a quote-unquote free-to-play game, I mean, it's definitely something that I wouldn't feel like a waste of money to resubscribe again, like, in a long-term basis. Like, it really is that much fun. And kind of seeing what the different things that were locked behind cartel coins or paid content, you know, most of it's not too bad. I mean, I think the biggest thing for me is that if you never had subscribed at all, then you would not have the ability to sprint, which I was just like, ugh, for me. But because I originally subscribed back in the day, I'm considered a preferred customer. And that means that even if I let my subscription lapse, that I'll still be able to at least sprint and stuff.
Excellent. Yeah, I totally feel you on the sprint issue, because when I first started playing, I also picked the game back up, and I also ended up subbing again for a month. But while I was playing, before I realized I had sprint, I was just like, God, characters move so slow in this game. Holy crap. But then once I realized I had sprint because I had been a subscriber in the past, definitely it was just like one of those quality of life.
I was wondering,
things.
I'm like,
how could I do without this?
I was wondering, like, why you were like 3 quest chains behind me at first.
Rude. But yeah, it was, oh man, that was rough. Hey, I caught up, though. I caught up.
You did.
Anyways, as you can tell, I'm also playing Star Wars The Old Republic. I've also been playing a lot of Smoosh Brothers. Obviously playing some,
Smoosh Brothers.
Smoosh Brothers. Been working out my, Mewtwo game. Also picked up Wario, and I've been working on him. So I'm basically now playing, like, Koopa Jr., Wario, and Ness. So it's like all of my characters are unlockables. Like, if I ever play somewhere that doesn't have the unlocks, I'm gonna be stuck in, like, a super basic situation.
Well, your Ike game is still strong.
My Ike game's alright. But the big surprise for me is that I've also been playing a lot of Marvel Puzzle Quest on iOS. This is a free-to-play game. And to me, the big shock here, I loved Puzzle Quest on the DS back in the day. I totally loved it. But I had forgotten sort of how into Puzzle Quest I was at the time. This has reminded me. Like, this is practically Nickelback. This is how it reminds me. I am all about Marvel Puzzle Quest right now. In fact, while recording this episode, I have checked my alliance in-game several times. Like, how are we doing on the Ultron event? I'm super into it. I'm super into, like, the fact that even though it's a free-to-play game, I think it's balanced super well. Certainly, Dominance by Whales does exist in some of the PvP sections, but you can play the game completely in PvE and never have to spend a dime and have a really fulfilling gameplay experience, which for me is kind of what Puzzle Quest would have to be all about. So I'm super into it. We have a Game Buoy alliance in-game. It's like a guild. So if you play it out there and you don't have an alliance, hit me up. I'd love to have you. And otherwise, just the game is super good, and I highly recommend it for anyone that's open to playing games on their phone. I know some people aren't, and, you know, I certainly don't blame you at all. With all that having been said, I think that's about all we're playing. So, Slaggy, do you have some social links for us tonight?
Yeah, we got a couple tweets over on twitter.com/gamebuoy.org with the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
Gamebuoy.org with the .org spelled out D-O-T-O-R-G.
So, Crystal Y. Diaz picked up on our mention of regionals when we were talking about Glee. She said, when I hear regionals, I think of Bring It On. Better choice.
Yeah, that is hashtag way better life choice.
Also saying, wow, facepalm, how could I have forgotten TMNT? I used to play the NES game all the time when I was a kid. And her wonderful husband, Dan Diaz, over on Twitter as Dan Diaz, said, thanks for not pointing out how lonely I was as a child, picking an RPG foursome instead of a multiplayer one. Yay.
Girl, you are among friends here. Like, I can't really speak for Slaggy, but I was certainly a lonely child.
I used to trade Pokemon with myself. Gamer Fox says, massaging my inner ear today. Sorry it took so long to start listening. And posted a screenshot of our Game Buoy Micro for The Brink of Time, 20 Years of Chrono Trigger. And said, later on, listened to two episodes of GameBuoy.org this morning and I'm now hooked. You guys are fab and thanks for all the shoutouts. Hee hee. And two little blushing emoji.
Well, thank you. You're fab yourself.
And you are all fab out there in Radioland when you give us subscriptions, reviews, and ratings on iTunes, when you like us on Facebook, when you tweet at us on Twitter, when you Tumble on, I guess some people maybe Tumblr. Is anyone still Google Plusing? Is Google Plus even going to last? I heard that it was kind of on the outs.
Well, I mean, it's Google, so it'll last however long they choose to keep it going.
And for emailing us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Of course, you can find our entire episode archive and all our social links over at gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org.
Spike, what's the realness, mama?
By this, you mean what are my shoutouts?
Yeah, what's the category here?
The
category is
VG Realness. What is serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends? As well as the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. I'd be remiss not to mention OLR, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. I also want to point you in the direction of the Nintendo Fun Club podcast, Platformers Positivity, and Pop Punk, as well as their side project, Enos Lives, which is taking a look at many well-loved and remembered PlayStation 1 games, one episode at a time. There's, of course, also the Nintendo Love Fest, as well as their sister show, X Nation, which you can find over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. There's also the Reading is Fundamental podcast, which is your show that also features myself, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness, talking about the current season of RuPaul's Drag Race. I'd also like you to listen to the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail, and last but never, ever, ever, ever least, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Slaggy, you know where to take us.
Well, I was just going to say, I just noticed that Tables, Ladders, and Podcast celebrated episode 100. Congratulations.
Yeah, they did. They did, and they had a really cool question of the week for it and everything, but I was going to a Giants game when it happened, so I didn't get to participate.
Aww.
And
well,
like, I feel bad, but also I was at a Giants game.
I want to take you to a game bar.
I want to take you to a game bar.
Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Hump Companion and a part of the Hunty Bunch. Koopa Club, that's Koopa with a Q and Club with a K, is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist. And I believe the award was from their mothers. Maybe that's why they are such fans of game shows, because, you know, moms. Over on the Voice of Geeks Network, you can check out some shows, including Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO, and Horde House, the place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously. Over on FistfulOfPotions.com, you can listen to the Multitap podcast, which is a podcast discussion in the round about gaming then and now. And last but certainly not least, I'd like to shout out to La Palanca Podcast, podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. As ever and always, our wonderful theme music was done by Zelda Reorchestrated, the project that aimed to reorchestrate beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. They unfortunately has long since shut their doors, and we'll be forever putting out a 40 into the Great Fairy Fountain.
All right, our lovely and beautiful listeners out there in Radioland, it is that time, as always comes, where we are at an end. I hope that you guys have had as much fun listening to us as we've had talking to you, and we look forward to our next episode, where, you know, we're going to get to talk to you guys. We're also looking forward to the E3 festivities in June, so definitely stay tuned for that. We're definitely going to be one-upping our already over-the-top coverage from last year. Please look forward to it. However, in the meantime, keep gaming, keep thinking, and see you, Space Cowboy. Are you ready?
Wah, I'm Waluigi. I'm gonna win.
Here's my normal speaking voice, which is not as loud as the Waluigi.
Very good. Levels look right.
hot mics, get your hot mics here.
We have already established that the mics are hot. Jesus.
Get your magic mics here.
Okay.
Drop your drawers.
All right, you've gone too far.
More things with the orcs and such.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
We also got word here that E's Chronicles...
So controversial.
Could our boy Roy and Street Fighter 3 be the next SSB 40, you see?
Ah!
Our boy Roy.
Ah!
It's my boy Roy.
Ah!
My boy.
My boy.